You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Hey everybody, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeslein, happy to be with you for the next 60 minutes. We've got a great full show coming at you. Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center down in Wabasha, who's going to check in. Ed's going to talk to us about a first day of issue event that they've got cooking with the U.S. Postal Service. So we'll talk to him about that a little bit. That's going to be this Thursday, May 14th. We will also have Brad Gausman from the Minnesota Conservation Federation. There's some things cooking at the state capitol that state sportsmen and women need to be aware of. We'll get his take on that before the session ends, May 17th. But let's kick it off right now with Tim Lesmeister. He joins me every week to start the show. Tim, good to see you. Fishing opener weekend. That's the big news, isn't it?
Well, we're very fortunate this year, aren't we? Good weather. The bite is on fire. You never know where the bite is. I was talking to Gary Roach, and I said, what do you think, Gary? Is it going to be a little early, a little late, on time? Because if it's early, you're fishing for spawning walleyes. If it's late, these fish have already moved out into the deeper water. And if you catch it in between, your fishing fish that are spread out all over, that's the normal situation. And he says he thinks it's actually going to be a little bit later than normal. He said the water did cool down, but we had that early warm up and the ice went off a little earlier this year, just a little bit earlier this year. He says he thinks that a lot of the fish are going to be already situated on structure and it's going to be a great bite. So he said there's going to be a lot of fish caught this weekend, and it's just going to be a lot of Sunday afternoon fish fries.
We've certainly had cooler temperatures, but, you know, the 2 weeks leading up to opener, at least, you know, going into, you know, now then Friday and the weekend, it's looking like it's going to be at least normal temperature. So it should be perfect fishing conditions. I think a lot of people are going to be out taking advantage of the beautiful weather this weekend. I'll trust Gary Roach and what he said. I think it's going to be a pretty typical opener. You know, opener conditions are usually challenging for walleyes. They're usually in kind of a post-spawn mood. That's why the best walleye fishing is usually the end of the month and getting into June. I think it's going to be a pretty typical year out there. It sounds like bait is in decent shape. It's not, we're not overflowing with bait, but I'm not hearing the word shortages. I think if you go to a couple bait shops, you're going to find the minnows and even some small leeches that you're going to need for this opener weekend.
Yeah, I thought it was funny because Ron Scherer had a column in, it was last week's paper, about how guys like Roach always say, make sure you take plenty of different kinds of bait. You have to have your shiners, your fatheads, your leeches, your night crawlers. He says, hey, you might not be able to afford your boat just because you got to buy all that bait. I think it's pretty funny. But, you know, it is one of those things where you really don't know what you're going to have to deal with out there. Are you going to be fishing deep, shallow, somewhere in between? Are they going to be going on minnows? Are they going to be going on leeches? It's so hard to tell that you got to pretty much be prepared. So, you know, you might think to yourself, the rainbow shiners or the, you know, small sucker minnows are going to be the ticket. And so always take a bunch of those and know that, yeah, you should have at least a dozen crawlers and maybe a dozen leeches along. It won't break your bank.
Young Justin Runberg here at Outdoor News is going to be attending the Governor's Fishing Opener, which is in Stillwater this year, Tim, so not too far from the Metro. That's always a good event, maybe not as big a deal as it used to be, but I'm hoping the Governor has some luck fishing. It's his last opener, isn't it, as a Governor of the fine state of Minnesota for Tim Walz.
Yeah, governors don't ever seem to have too much luck fishing because they don't want to really, you know, fish hard, be out on the water and fish hard. The only governor that I ever, you know, went out with, and I started with Rudy Perpich back in the day, that really wanted to fish hard was Tim Pawlenty. Most of these guys go out for an hour, maybe two, and they do a little bit of fishing, hope that you put them on the right spot, that they can just get one bite. If they can hold up one fish and get a picture, they're happy. But Pawlenty, he used to go out and he used to fish hard all day long and sometimes both days, Saturday and Sunday, and he used to catch fish. But these governors these days, they don't really care much if they catch a fish or not. It's just basically trying to let people know that they care about their area, the resources, and that they want you to enjoy what is one of Minnesota's oldest traditions.
Jesse Ventura fished pretty hard the 4 years he was governor. I give him credit for that. I didn't necessarily like the way he ran the Department of Natural Resources, but I went to at least one or two of his openers, and it seemed like Jesse worked pretty hard. You know who really hated the opener was Arne Carlson.
Oh, yes.
He was very open about his disdain for going out in the boat. I heard there were years he refused to put bait on his hook, that you know he was out there just marking some time just to do it. And that's back when openers were pretty well regarded. I mean, a governor was obligated to really go all in on it.
There was one guy, his last name was Anderson. It was a guide on Lake Mille Lacs that took Carlson out on Mille Lacs during one of the fishing openers. And he worked his tail off to catch him a fish, but they never did. They were out for just a couple hours. And he was so disappointed because, you know, his one opportunity to really showcase his abilities, and then he had to end up get stuck with Carlson as governor. It was too bad.
Well, I hope everybody has good fishing this weekend. I think you're going to, and if not, hang in there 2 weeks from now, Memorial Day weekend. And of course, as we get into June, I think walleye fishing is going to be great statewide. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline and Tim Lesmeister kicking it off. Tim, the big story broke last week after we recorded last week's show. It's official. We got cougar breeding activity within the borders of Minnesota. This is what we've been waiting to see forever. I mean, we've seen a lot of pictures of individual lone cougars, a lot. I mean, it's sounded like over 100 in the past decade or so. We've had individual cougar shots. But this is the first documented video. I mean, incredible video. I don't know if you saw it, Tim. I mean, you can hear these cats purring and snarling at each other. We got a mama cat way up in border country with three young ones. Beautiful images, and I'm not ready to say that cougars are recolonizing the region, but it's certainly a toehold.
I think it's fantastic that this is happening. When you posted it up on the Outdoor News Facebook page, I had to comment jokingly that it's just a matter of time before they start attacking runners and bicyclists like they do out in the western states. But I think it's fantastic if the cougars get a hold, like you say, a toehold in the state. I think it would be great. Just another predator that can get the deer hunters all ticked off.
So, yeah, I shared the Outdoor News post. You commented on that. But there were hundreds of comments on the Outdoor News post. And, I mean, some of them were just, come on, people. Are you serious? You know, saying that, you know, the DNR knew this all along. Other people saying they're being stalked by the DNR. It's like, well, the DNR issued the press release. They're clearly not being secretive about it. You know, and then, you know, other people saying, oh, we've known for years that we've had breeding cougars. And I appreciate the one guy who said pictures or it didn't happen. Because I am naturally skeptical of some of these crazy stories, especially given the volume of trail cameras we have out there now. I think if there were other cougars running around with cubs, we would see them on trail cameras. And as I said in my column, it's not coincidental that the two cases of breeding cougars that we now have in the upper Midwest, the Western Great Lakes region, one is up here on border country, Voyageurs National Park, some of the wildest, most remote country in the state of Minnesota. And the other is in extreme northern upper peninsula of Michigan, very sparsely populated, Porcupine Mountain country, big wild country with relatively few people running around. These cats, at least for now, they need space. And it's not coincidental that they're two in the wildest parts of the upper Midwest.
But did you notice that these animals that they always say need space can eventually find that they don't need space, and they tend to expand in areas where they might actually have a little more interaction with human beings? You know, you see wolves doing that, and some of these other animals like bobcats, fishers, good example. You talk about conspiracy theories. I know for a fact that the Department of Natural Resources is stocking armadillos in the Twin Cities area because they want to slow down traffic on 694.
And I alluded to this in my column a little bit, Tim. I remember 25, 30 years ago with wolves, they said they had to have X amount of roadless areas. You had to have areas with no roads. And certainly wolves have disproven that as you get down into central Wisconsin. I mean, there's wolves in central Wisconsin, and there's a lot of roads and a lot of agriculture. Now, there's also a lot of forest there, and I still think that's probably the limiting factor for some of these species, Tim. I think they do need forest. I don't think we're going to have wolves out on the agricultural part of Minnesota. If they can get down to southeast Minnesota, you might, I think it's possible you could have some there. It appears we got a few black bears kicking around in southeastern Minnesota. They're a little more versatile, black bears versus wolves. You know, you got cougars in fairly high populated areas of California, but I think they find wild places, right? They find some of the high country where they're able to get away from people.
Down in southeast Minnesota, like the Big Door and the Whitewater regions, the forests there would definitely, I think, be great places for wolves and cougars both. I wonder how that's going to work, though. You ever notice where there's a, you know, a very heavy population of wolves, you don't see any coyotes. I wonder if the cougar population would get knocked down by the wolf's population. So I don't know. You know, it would be interesting to see how, if they are capable of coexisting.
That's an interesting dynamic, Tim, because there's not a lot of places where you got both, at least in the lower 48. I believe John Erb brought that up. You know, will wolves kill these young cougar kits? I would think a pack of wolves would have a tough time with an adult female cougar. Just about every creature on the planet has a tough time with adult female or adult cougars of either sex. But it's an interesting dynamic, one that I guess we can watch play out. Tim, we should break. Lots more to talk about. We'll catch up with you at the end of the show.
Sounds good.
Tim Lesmeister, stick around. More of the broadcast after these messages.
From sunrise casts to sunset stories by the fire, Fireside Lodge is more than a fishing trip. It's an experience worth coming back to. Cast your line into pristine northwestern Ontario waters, reel in the catch of a lifetime, and unwind in comfort at the end of the day. Whether it's your first trip or an annual tradition, Fireside Lodge delivers the experience you've been waiting for. Book your 2026 adventure today at firesidelodge.com or call 1-800-545-0815.
For those walking the turkey woods this spring, carry a Bold Retay Gobbler shotgun. Top options include the Gordian Turkey Gun with its no-rattle inertia plus rotating bolt and factory-lengthened forcing cone, which delivers 20% more pellets. Or the Gamelander Turkey Single Shot, available in 410 and 20-gauge in black and mossy oak bottomland with its airy recoil reduction pad. Find a dealer locator at RetayUSA.com. That's RetayUSA.com. Be the Retay difference.
Spring coho and steelhead are on, and Ken's is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports: Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Ken Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
Some of the best Minnesota trips happen on the water. With Rainy Lake Houseboats, you can rent a fully equipped houseboat and explore the shoreline of Rainy Lake near Voyageurs National Park. Spend the day fishing, swimming, or tying up in a quiet bay and cooking dinner on board. To reserve your houseboat, call 1-800-554-9188. That number again is 1-800-554-9188 or visit rainylakehouseboats.com.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
You know the drill. You got a free Saturday, the boat's ready, but you're scrolling through the same tired fishing reports trying to figure out where to go. Stop guessing and start catching. Onyx Fish lets you filter thousands of Midwest lakes by species, trophy potential, even keeper size, all backed by real DNR survey data. Plus, Onyx Fish is brand new on Android, so no more excuses. Try free for 7 days. Download Onyx Fish on the App Store or Google Play. Your next favorite lake is out there. Go find it.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerislein with you for another segment. Thanks for tuning in. If you like the broadcast, please check us out online at outdoornews.com where you can subscribe to our print or digital versions. You can also do both of those things by calling 800-535-5191. I want to talk about a big event going on down in Wabasha this coming week, Thursday, May 14th. It's at the National Eagle Center, and here to talk about what's cooking down there is Ed Hahn. He is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Wabasha-based National Eagle Center. Ed, thanks for joining me for a segment.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the National Eagle Center. I don't believe I've ever had a guest on from the Eagle Center. It's a great asset here in the state of Minnesota. It's a beautiful facility. Tell us about the National Eagle Center and why it ended up in Wabasha.
So we are now in our 27th year of operation there in Wabasha, and we're kind of a unique venue. We're a little bit of a nature center, but we're also a museum, and a part of our collection is living bald eagles and other raptors. So currently we are home to 6 permanently injured but rescued raptors. We have 4 bald eagles, we have 1 red-tailed hawk, and then we just recently added and debuted an American kestrel to our team. So we're really thrilled about that. You know, what people come to us for is really kind of a variety of things. We obviously have the live eagle ambassadors that they can meet each and every day when they go there, but we really do broader nature and environmental and conservation education, but it's all through the lens of raptors, specifically bald eagles for the most part. And yeah, we're just kind of connecting people to the natural world. Certainly there are cultural and historical elements to it as well, and that is reflected in our programs and our exhibits. And so, yeah, it's just it's a really unique experience. You know, there are other venues in the state, obviously, that have bald eagles on display that you can go and see. But the way we handle that and do that at the National Eagle Center, as far as we are aware, is wholly unique.
The website is nationaleaglecenter.org. So very easy if folks want to check out and learn more about the facility that I'm talking about with Ed. Not only do you have eagles on the inside of the facility, eagle ambassadors, as you said, but the Mississippi River, that Wabasha area, and even downstream, Winona, Trumbull, that area, one of the best places in the country to view wild bald eagles, right? That's in part why it was built where it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Outside of Alaska, which by, you know, leaps and bounds, far and away the highest population and highest concentration of bald eagles in North America, or certainly in any of the 50 states, this is the best place to view them. So we're really fortunate here in the upper Mississippi River Valley to have the eagle population that we do, to have the year-round viewing that we do. It's really no accident that we are located in Wabasha. It grows out of the fact that when bald eagles were still a pretty rare sight to see, Wabasha was one of the places to go to see them, and it still is today.
I remember in the early 90s, I was living in Winona and I was a subscriber. I believe it was Outside Magazine did a story on, you know, like top 10 places to watch and see eagles around the country. And they did not include the upper Mississippi River. And I don't think I wrote a letter, but I was furious about it because I think it arrived in my mailbox like in March, right when a ton of eagles are moving through that area. And I believe it was like within a day or two, I walked the Trumbull National Wildlife Refuge as ice was going out. And of course, there's a lot of dead fish and carrion as ice is going on. And I think I counted like 120 eagles that day just on the ice. It's a great place to view eagles. It's hard not to see an eagle if you're cruising around that part of the state, especially in late winter.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, now that the bald eagle population really has, I mean, not only are they no longer endangered, they came off the endangered species list in 2007 as well, but their population has really boomed. I've heard figures, I don't have an exact count, I don't think anyone knows the exact number, but I've heard reports that they believe in North America, the bald eagle population is as large as it's ever been since the arrival of Europeans, which says that that population has fully recovered from the brink of extinction. And to your point about just the wonderful venue we have here on the Upper Mississippi River, we offer year-round experiences at the center that really make the most of that. We have winter field trips that we take people out, and we go looking for both bald eagles and golden eagles, which are here in the winter season. And then we also, during the summer months, have our river cruises, which actually our summer season starts later this month. And we go out and we look at nest sites and just observe, you know, eagles out in the wild. And certainly we see other wildlife as well. But those are the kind of experiences outside of just visiting the center that we make available to people. Yeah, I mean, you really can't, I think, overstate the opportunities that we have in this part of the country. I mean, not only is it the Mississippi River is one of the biggest rivers in the world, and we see that with our international visitors. They come to Wabash and are very excited to be right on the banks of the Mississippi. But there's just so much wildlife, and that's not even just bald eagles. There's just a wealth of different species of birds, whether it's songbirds or waterfowl, and just other animals that we almost take for granted in this part of the country that people can learn about and see firsthand when they join us on our experiences.
Ed, real quick, you mentioned the golden eagles that are kind of in that bluff country border area of Minnesota and Wisconsin. My parents used to participate in your eagle watch, your golden eagle watch, but they winter somewhere else now, so they haven't been doing that. Are there as many golden eagles wintering in that area as there were before, or has it plateaued? Any idea off the top of your head?
Yeah, that's a great question. The research is really ongoing. What's interesting about golden eagles and our understanding of them in North America specifically is that it's a relatively recent understanding that we even have golden eagles in the eastern part of the United States at all. If you look back at kind of birding books and birding guides, even from the late 90s, and you look at the range map for golden eagles in North America, you really would not see any presence of them indicated east of the Mississippi River. And so for the last 25 years, we have been running a program called the Golden Eagle Survey. And it's not the only one anymore that's actually up and running. There are other surveys in the eastern part of the United States. We go out, we have trained volunteers. We all go out on the same Saturday in January every year. And we're basically just counting and all the gold eagles that we observe. That survey is specifically for golden eagles. Our surveyors basically report everything they see. And so we are tracking other populations as well. But, you know, to your question, it's hard to know if the population is expanding, if it's staying steady, because you do get fluctuation year to year on those counts. Sometimes it just has to do with the weather. You know, some years we go out and it's just, you know, where it's overcast, it's socked in with fog, and so the visibility is bad. But even on regular years, you do have some variation. Now, we do know through some previous catch and release with satellite transmitters, we've been able to track those golden eagles. And so we know exactly where this specific population of eagles is nesting. And so in the wintertime, they are literally migrating south, in some cases, 2,000 miles or more into parts of the eastern United States. We certainly have them here in the Bluff Country, in the Coulee region. You won't find them really in the Mississippi River Valley proper. That's how they differ from bald eagles, which are very much water birds. But golden eagles are upland predators, so you're going to find them back in the Bluff Country. But they have also been spotted in places like the Ozarks. There's some ongoing research going on in the Appalachians. We've learned a couple years ago about a program that even down in Alabama where they are doing some golden eagle research and surveys. It's a very specific population of golden eagles. They are nesting during this time of the year just south of the Arctic Circle up in Nunavut, which is up in extreme northern Canada. And so they are only here in this part of the country in the wintertime.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline chatting with Ed Hahn. Ed is the Marketing and Communications Director for the Wabasha, Minnesota-based National Eagle Center. You got a big event coming up this Thursday, May 14th. The U.S. Postal Service is doing its first day of issue. I remember that term from when I was a kid and collected stamps of a series of five bald eagle stamps designed by David Allen Sibley. He's very well known among birders, responsible for all the images and a very popular bird watching book. So this is an exciting event, and it's open to the public.
That is correct. Yep. So a week from this Thursday on the 14th, we will be hosting this first day of issue ceremony at the National Eagle Center that will be taking place outside the center in the Riverfront Amphitheater there in Wabasha. It's free to attend, open to the public. It will be featuring several invited speakers will be part of that program. We anticipate it'll be about 45 minutes to an hour in length. That will be at 11 a.m., but our doors at the center open at 10 a.m., and the Postal Service will also be starting sales of those stamps on site at 10 a.m. as well on the 14th. So, yeah, we invite people to come to Wabasha, check it out. We've had a lot of people reach out to us since the announcement went out that our stamp collectors, also bird enthusiasts, who are eagerly anticipating getting their hands on this series of stamps. So, yeah, it should be a great event. Hopefully the weather cooperates for us, but it's really exciting. And of course, 2 years ago in December of 2024, the bald eagle was officially declared the national bird of the United States. And so part of the 250th anniversary of the United States here in 2026, they are issuing this commemorative forever stamp featuring the bald eagle. So yeah, we're honored that the Postal Service decided to host that event in Wabasha at the National Eagle Center, and we're really looking forward to sharing that experience.
And Mr. Sibley, David Allen Sibley, will be on hand, is my understanding. Attendees are encouraged to register at www.usps, that's U.S. Postal Service, usps.com/bald-eagle-stamps. You can find more information and you can register. Should be quite a party. One more time, this Thursday, May 14th, down in Wabasha, Minnesota at the National Eagle Center. Ed, thanks a lot for joining me. Good luck with the event. I suspect you're going to have a surly crowd of, what, philatelists? Is that what they call themselves? Stamp collectors?
Yeah, no, we're excited to do it. It should be a great event, and we're just really excited to be able to share that experience with all the people who come out. So should be a great time.
NationalEagleCenter.org, one more time if you want more information. Ed, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center down in Wabasha, Minnesota. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
Here's a way to give back to the future of waterfowl. Volunteer with Ducks Unlimited. From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, Ducks Unlimited has been protecting and restoring critical habitat for nearly 90 years. We're working toward our next million-acre milestone, and we need your help. Whether you're great at selling event tickets, securing donations, lining up sponsors, or pitching in wherever, there's a role for everyone. Join the team that's making a real difference. Head to ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
You know the drill. You got a free Saturday, the boat's ready, but you're scrolling through the same tired fishing reports trying to figure out where to go. Stop guessing and start catching. Onyx Fish lets you filter thousands of Midwest lakes by species, trophy potential, even keeper size, all backed by real DNR survey data. Plus, Onyx Fish is brand new on Android, so no more excuses. Try free for 7 days. Download Onyx Fish on the App Store or Google Play. Your next favorite lake is out there. Go find it.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Some of the best Minnesota trips happen on the water. With Rainy Lake Houseboats, you can rent a fully equipped houseboat and explore the shoreline of Rainy Lake near Voyageurs National Park. Spend the day fishing, swimming, or tying up in a quiet bay and cooking dinner on board. To reserve your houseboat, call 1-800-554-9188. That number again is 1-800-554-9188 or visit rainylakehouseboats.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Gerisline. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you like the chatter here. If so, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to print or digital or both versions there. Now, a gentleman who hasn't been with us in a while. I think it's been a couple years since Brad Gausman has joined us. He's the executive director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation. There's a lot going on at the state capitol as the session winds down. I want to talk to Brad about. But before we do that, Brad, this is the first time we've talked since your organization had a bit of a name change.
We did. Thanks for having me. So as you said, I'm executive director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation, and our organization recently changed our name. From about 1936 until last January, we were Minnesota Conservation Federation, but our board of directors saw an opportunity to kind of rebrand a bit, re-engage with folks across Minnesota, and create a little bit of a closer connection with our independent affiliation with National Wildlife Federation and all of our surrounding states that also have wildlife federations as well.
Yeah, as long as I've been around, the Conservation Federation was the state affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation, and the name change kind of makes the two sound a little more in sync, I guess you might say.
It does, and also provide an opportunity to get a fun new logo and kind of new website and emails that kind of speak to our body of work advocating for wildlife and outdoor spaces in Minnesota.
The website is mnwildlife.org, and you've got a fairly new, younger, robust board of directors. Tell us about that, too.
Yeah, we've worked the last few years to kind of onboard conservationists kind of with unique skills and interests to aid in helping us accomplish our mission. So brought on a number of folks that are engaged in our in-person programming and have kind of skill sets around specific issues we're interested in, such as foraging and advocating for native rough fish.
Well, let's talk about the breaking news, the important news that's cooking at the state legislature. The session ends, I think, is it May 17th or 18th?
I think it's just, 17th.
Just over a week away, so coming up fast. And as of early this past week, I wrote part of my column about this, Brad, to the environment committees and the full legislature had not passed the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council Outdoor Heritage Fund bill, which is important. There's like $191 million at stake there. This hasn't been a problem for a long time. It seems like it usually passes through without too much issue. What seems to be cooking here in 2026? Your organization issued an action alert on the matter last weekend.
Yeah, you know, the appropriations of the legislature for legacy bills is really important to make sure that we get legacy dollars on the ground making the most impact possible. The Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council approves projects. You mentioned $191 million. That was over 53 individual projects that were approved as a package unanimously by that council and then sent to the legislature, who is charged with appropriating those funds. And, you know, we have a robust system in Minnesota of kind of legacy councils that make those recommendations, do a lot of the vetting work to make sure those projects are appropriate and in line with the spending of the funds. And then we kind of go through the legislative process to make sure that those dollars are appropriated. Typically, the legislature has kind of approved projects with kind of the approval of those legacy councils. This legislative session, there was a bit more of a holdup with some discussions around one specific project up in the Roseau area, and then conversations about kind of structure and governance of the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council as well. So that kind of held it up a bit, and we're waiting to see how it all plays out. It sounds like there is a Senate bill that passed through two committees with those Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations. So we'll see where the House goes. But it's really critical that these funds get passed. The Outdoor Heritage Funds are appropriated annually. And so it's really a positive thing when the legislature kind of takes action to put those conservation dollars on the ground.
Yeah, as I wrote in my column, this has generally gone pretty smoothly over the years. These are state tax dollars that are dedicated through that sales tax dedication that we passed in 2008. So this isn't general fund. These are dollars that are earmarked specifically for these projects. And it's important that we get these dollars in the ground, right? The sooner they get in the ground, the better. In the early days of this, Brad, I don't know if you recall, this might have been before your time, when we would interview gubernatorial candidates out at game fair, we would get them on the record. Will you demand that the legislature respect the will of the council and, you know, what the council says, basically the legislature would support? And, you know, governors all were on board with that. I remember, I think it was in 2013, we had some urban Democrats try to add a bunch of spending for, I think there were some AIS dollars, as well as some Metro dollars that were added. The council had not approved them. And Governor Dayton line item vetoed those out of those. He abided by his pledge that he made at game fair that he wanted the will of the council to be respected. And it seemed like ever since then, that kind of set a precedence, you know, that we, okay, the legislature's not going to mess with this until this year came along. We got a couple amendments. You mentioned the one involving Roseau River. The other two, one involves maybe a more substantial process for hiring an executive director of the council. There was a little bit of scuttlebutt about how thorough that process happened this last time around. And then also, should members have term limits? And as I said in my column, I'm not necessarily offended by either of those two amendments, but I don't want them to bog down the process so that we don't get this passed this year. Perhaps, you know, what Republicans should do is offer those as separate bills during the 2027 session, you know, that come up through the Environment Committee process.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, there's always an opportunity to look at how to strengthen processes and the activities of councils, you know, especially within kind of the legacy environment. So there is a time and place to have those, and the legislature is kind of discussing, you know, is that appropriate in committee? Should it come from the council itself? Should the legislature be charged with kind of recommending back to the committee those changes?
Brad, cutting to the chase, per your action alert last weekend, what can listeners do? What should they be doing here? The idea is we want to get these bills passed. How can listeners out there make that happen?
Getting in touch with your elected representatives is always a positive thing. You know, having constituents reach out to their elected leaders, you know, let your representatives know that you value the Lizard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council's recommendations, and you want to see the Minnesota legislature pass an outdoor heritage funding bill that puts conservation dollars on the ground across the state, and that they really respect the recommendations of the Outdoor Heritage Council.
Yeah, these are our dedicated funds. They need to be spent appropriately. Get it done. That's a simple message that I think every citizen should tell their state rep or their state senator. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreesen. We're chatting with Brad Galsman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation. Hey, before we go, Brad, the governor signed some proclamation on Friday, May 8th, that has to do with native roughfish? Tell us about that briefly.
Yeah, that's right. We're really excited as an organization to be involved, and we're kind of recognizing some of the amazing native rough fish in Minnesota that were reclassified recently as such, and are really excited that on Friday, May 8th, right before the Minnesota fishing opener, the governor will proclaim May 8th to be Native Rough Fish Day in Minnesota. So maybe a great opportunity kind of right before the kind of the typical game fish opener to go out, maybe target some of those unique species and really appreciate all of the amazing fish that swim in, you know, creeks, rivers, streams and lakes across Minnesota.
Yeah, these species have kind of a new designation now as native rough fish, and there's also some new limits that the DNR is proposing for them also. So new respect for our rough fish, not to be confused with common carp, which are our worst aquatic invasive species, as well as the invasive carp making their way up, the invasive Asian carp making their way up the Mississippi River. But we're talking like bigmouth buffalo, quillback sucker, all of our red horse species, some of those others. I'm with you. I'm glad these fish are getting newfound respect.
Yeah, me too. And I'll say, I think my favorite is the drummer, the sheep's head. Once I learned that they eat zebra mussels let's get more healthy populations of drum in our state to maybe help battle that AIS problem.
Used to catch a lot of them on the river when I was a kid. Well, anyway, Brad, thanks a lot for joining me. I'd encourage folks to visit your website, mnwildlife.org. Follow you on some of the social media platforms also, and keep track of some of those action alerts like the one you guys issued last week, urging membership as well as citizens statewide to contact their state senator or rep and tell them to get the Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars in the pipeline before the session wraps up.
That's right. Any advocacy from the public on this issue would be greatly appreciated.
Brad, have a good fishing opener weekend, and we'll talk to you in the future.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the opener yourself.
That was Brad Gausman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation, mnwildlife.org. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Your hunt starts with healthy wetlands and the habitats that support them. From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, across America's Great Plains and down the Mississippi Delta, Ducks Unlimited has protected and restored habitat for nearly 90 years. We need your help to reach our next million-acre milestone and ensure waterfowl for generations to come. Whether you're selling tickets, securing donations, or finding that next sponsor, there's a role for everyone. Join today at ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Spring coho at Steelhead are on, and Kins is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports. Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced, rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Kins Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
There are lakes across Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and beyond that are loaded with fish. And nobody's talking about them. Onyx Fish helps you find them. Search by species. Filter for big walleyes, trophy panfish, or eater crappies. Check satellite imagery, depth maps, and public access points. All before you leave the house. And now, Onyx Fish is available on Android for the first time. iPhone, Android, doesn't matter. Just download it and start planning. 7-day free trial, then just $35 a year. Onyx Fish. Find new lakes, get there with confidence.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
From sunrise casts to sunset stories by the fire, Fireside Lodge is more than a fishing trip. It's an experience worth coming back to. Cast your line into pristine northwestern Ontario waters, reel in the catch of a lifetime, and unwind in comfort at the end of the day. Whether it's your first trip or an annual tradition, Fireside Lodge delivers the experience you've been waiting for. Book your 2026 adventure today at firesidelodge.com or call 1-800-545-0815.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today.
Everybody, welcome back. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Zerisline. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like the content here, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to digital or print versions, or you can get both with your subscription. Actually, print subscription now, you get digital that comes with that. Back to Tim Lesmeister, a number of headlines I want to broach with him before we wrap up this week. One, it looks like the crossbow thing is set forever. We still had kind of the sunset that got pushed off last year. The legislature approved crossbows during the general archery season in 2023. We've had 3 years of it. We've been debating whether or not we should continue pushing back the sunset or making it permanent. It looks like the legislature made it permanent, Tim, and it looks like he was unanimous. I don't know if any legislator voted against it.
Not a single one. This is obviously a piece of legislation that is very much a nonpartisan issue because it was passed across the board by both Democrats and Republicans. And here's what I don't understand, though. They said that crossbows basically are here to stay. The youth and the females are the ones that are actually picking up on this. You're seeing a lot more of that going on. There was no negativity at all among the legislative body. There's, according to the Department of Natural Resources, no negative effect at all on deer or turkey numbers. Yet you still have the Minnesota bow hunters that are against it. Really? Really? What is with you guys? Come on. I just don't understand why you would look at all of the positives that are going with this and still be negative about it.
Well, Tim, you got to go and get me going here. You know, the DNR issued a report on basically how the first 2 years went. It's a tiny, tiny data set. We'll continue to see, you know, how this plays out. As you and I have discussed, I'm a little worried what it might mean for antlerless deer permits for some firearms hunters. Yes, women and kids like crossbows. They're using them. That doesn't, you know, if we saw a bump in licenses, it's 1 or 2%, which could be attributed to a lot of different things. Maybe crossbows had something to do with it. It shouldn't have been unanimous, Tim. There should have been a couple legislators who said, yeah, you know what? I am a little concerned about the extra pressure this might put on our deer herd and our antlerless tags in some areas. You know, we created the archery season to be difficult, and now it's basically just another gun hunt. I'm exaggerating a little bit there. And the fact that not a single legislator was able to parse that out tells me how disconnected they are from outdoor issues. Out of 200 plus legislators, one or two of them should have said, yeah, I'm not going to support this. Clearly, I'm the voice crying into the 80 mile an hour wind on this one, and it's time to move on.
Just keep yelling into the abyss at this point here. I believe that the crossbows are going to be around forever.
Yeah, no, clearly they are. So I like to think that can be the last word. Another legislative item going on, Tim. Well, of course, this happened last year in 2025. The legislature got rid of the shotgun zone in the southern portion of the state. Over the winter and into the early spring, we had a lot of county boards voting on whether or not their county should be rifle or shotgun in the southern half of the state. And it looks like the results are pretty much in. It sounds like the enforcement needs to go through it and maybe determine if there's a few zones that are going to need to change or something like that. But for the most part, we know it looks like about 13 counties in the southern part of the state, Tim, decided that they want to stick to shotgun only, and the rest of the state is going to be rifle.
My prediction is that will narrow quite a bit over the next few years. I think that eventually it's going to be all rifle and there will be no shotgun, maybe one or two counties that are shotgun only. And they're just going to, you know, basically say to heck with hunters. We don't care if we get hunters here. Our local population is fine just using shotguns and we'll just let the locals hunt this county because you won't get anybody that comes from outside of that county in there to hunt. Unless they have family, because they're going to want to use their rifles. So if they'll move into rifle zones because they just know that it's a much more efficient way to kill deer and that their success rate will go up dramatically. So I think that it's just a matter of time before the shotgun zones disappear completely.
So, yeah, the vast majority of the state, like 85% of the state this fall, is going to allow rifles. That's going to be, you know, vastly different. I don't know, Tim, if there'll be a little backlash. I mean, you're going to have a lot of rural landowners who are going to be hearing rifles going off now instead of shotguns. If there might be some backlash to that, probably not enough to turn a county the other way. I generally agree with what you just said. I think it might be slow, but I think you know, in 10 years, we might be down to a couple counties that are shotgun only. I guess I'm a little surprised as many counties decided to go rifle that more, only 13 decided to stick with shotgun.
What they should have done is they should have said, if you guys don't want to go pure rifle, you should at least allow those counties to go with straight wall cartridge in a rifle, you know, use a 350 or a 450 straight wall cartridge, because that's what Iowa has done. And it's really worked out well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think a lot of county board members have the bandwidth to understand the difference between a straight walled and a regular cartridge. But anyway, well, we will continue to watch this, and we'll let listeners know if the DNR has anything to say about what the final tally will be going into this fall's deer hunting season. The DNR wanted to get all these counties on board and find out what they were going to do by this past Tuesday, May 5th. And so it should be pretty well locked down. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Zerisan and Tim Lesmeister are wrapping up this week's show, bringing it home. Tim, another thing that happened after we recorded last week, Minnesota-based wildlife artist, one of the top two or three artists, wildlife artists in the history of Minnesota, passed away at the age of 96, David Moss, Orono-based guy. I don't know that I ever met Dave face-to-face. I think I talked to him on the phone a time or two. But, I mean, after Les Kuba, I think Dave's right up there as the most well-known waterfowling artist in the history of Minnesota.
Yeah, this guy has been a staple in Minnesota wildlife art with the amount of stuff that he has put out there. And, you know, he was always very good about donating to causes and stuff. And he's going to be missed. There's no doubt about it. He was one of the great ones.
A two-time federal duck stamp winner. I think five-time Ducks Unlimited Artist of the Year. Really the standard for waterfowl art, I would say. I don't know if there was anyone better. I mean, Les Kuba was distinctive with his bluebills. And, of course, we got the Houtmans that are very good. But, you know, I talked to Jimmy Houtman. He said, man, David Moss was one of the guys who inspired me.
You know, it's funny. You're talking about Les Kuba. I was in a gallery. This was probably 10 years ago. And I was just thumbing through these prints that were down in the, you know, budget section. And there was a Kuba for like $20. I couldn't believe it. That thing's, you know, probably worth $400 or $500. I bought it. It's hanging here in my house. But I've never seen a Moss as long as I've shopped in these places. I've only been lucky enough to find a Kuba.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody made mallards more interesting than David Moss. Great stuff. Rest in peace, David Moss. Tim, before we go, a crazy little story out in New Jersey, go figure. You see this video of the people battling this beaver? What did you make? Did you think they were pestering the beaver? It was their fault?
I think whenever you have dogs and you're walking by water, you're taking your chances. In Florida, a gator's going to come out and grab your dog. In New Jersey, it's going to be a beaver. Why do they do this? Because they're protecting something. That beaver was probably protecting young beavers that, you know, and so it obviously came out and it got into a tussle with these individuals who basically fought with this beaver, picked it up, threw it into the water. And it's quite an interesting video. I don't know if you could call it animal harassment or not, but man, oh man, it was something that's obviously going to be going viral here, because it was the battle between the beaver and the buttheads.
I tell you, I've been around a long time. I've never seen video of someone throwing a beaver back into a lake before. That was a new one on me. You know, and you see a lot of comments like, oh, beavers are peaceful. Leave the beavers alone. And hey, you know, I agree with everything you said. You don't want to be pestering beavers. You got to be careful with them around your dog. But anyone who has spent a lot of time out of doors on the water knows beavers they're very territorial. I would not describe beavers as peaceful.
I'm a trout fisherman, and I'll tell you what, I have been chased by beavers twice, and it's because you're crossing a beaver dam, and you get to the other side, and here's this beaver comes poking its head out of the water and says, I don't like you, and comes out of the water to, you know, to basically show you that this is my territory, and it chases you off. But the beautiful thing is they're not real fast. You can actually, and I don't think they really want to catch you. I think they just want to scare you a little bit, and so they kind of push you off. But yeah, beavers can be aggressive.
Yes, absolutely. That's something I've learned a number of times in my life, from the Boundary Waters down to the Mississippi River Valley. Anyway, Tim, good stuff. Thanks for spending time with me again this week, and you have a good week ahead.
We'll catch up to you soon.
Tim Lesmeister. Everybody, have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline, signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.